us all powerful, because even as we proceed in the study of Zen or any of the Othman Sufi mysticisms, this peculiar suspension of knowing in the total state of itself is invincible. It is the parent of all powers. It is the only thing which in a strange way may produce many things, but never be in itself shaken or moved. Thus Zeus has a strange relationship to the absolute autocracy of the thing as it is. No matter what you want to do about anything, whatever it is, it is. Whatever you want to do about universal law, about the gods, about men, about creation, about science, art, or literature, you must finally come to the point where you shrug your shoulders and say, that which is, is. There's nothing more we can do about it. So this isness of it is the strange power which makes Zeus the supreme autocrat. Zeus, through a series of generations of many kinds, fills this strange group of worlds which we have described under the rulership of these five levels of divine attributes. Some of these worlds, incidentally, belong to the titanic preceding cycles of existence. Others emerge as children of Zeus himself. Later we will try to differentiate those more clearly, but at the moment it would interfere with our general thinking. Instead of that, therefore, we will say here is the state of interior true fact, the thing as it is, nature according to being, instead of according to seeming or appearing to be. And the clouds moving over the face of the great Olympian height divide the universe into being and appearing. Everything above those clouds is being. Everything below those clouds is seeming or appearing to be. For all fact lies above the clouds, and all principles reside there. And it is their extension into a state of non-reality which gives them tangibility to us. Therefore, we perceive according to the error of things rather than according to the fact of things. And our way of knowing is by discovering that this and that and something else, they are not true. We discover that which is, not by directly finding it, but by discovering that which it is not, or that which is not. And in all definition of principles, we must approach by virtue of the language itself, always in the negative. The moment we say what a thing is, we make it less. The only thing we can do is to try to discover that which is not itself, and that which remains is whatever itself may be. Now this brings us to another pretty little part of our grammar. For out of the nature of being, born out of the striving of spirit and matter, and made fructified or fruitful by time, emerges this fact, the fact of being, that which exists forever in the state of being identical with being and of a conscious at one with being without thought. Now this remains static, however, and that is one of the difficulties that has been pointed out in connection with Eastern philosophy, that if you get into this state, you do nothing, and that is considered to be bad. Of course, this is a question, because when you get out of this state, you do all kinds of things, but they're not important, so you can decide for yourself. Now, of all the progeny of Zeus, of all the creatures fashioned out of the state of being, all except one is the result of a polarization. It is a result of the state of being entering into conspiracy with one of these planes that we have expressed. Zeus as being taking upon itself or himself one of his attributes or forms, goes forth into some realm or sphere, perhaps goes, as he does on one occasion, into the land of Cadmus, and there he woos Semele, the daughter of Cadmus, and from this union is born Dionysius Zagreus, the Savior. But Zeus came forth into this world, or into that sphere. He went to Cadmus in one of the mildest of his forms, it is said. He went only as a spirit. He came unembodied, as in the ancient legend, Cupid first came to Psyche, Eros appearing first as only a voice, but never seen. And it was only when Hera, whose peculiar attributes of intuition had been violated by this union, takes upon herself the form of the old woman and forces upon Semele doubt as to the nature of the mysterious spirit that overshadows her, that Semele then exacts from Zeus the fulfillment of a promise that he will do anything that she asks. He then takes the oath, the great oath of Zeus, taken by the river Styx. The great oath, therefore, that is taken in the land that divides the mind from desire, and promises that he will grant her wish. Semele, then very much like Psyche in the parallel myth, then demands that Zeus shall appear to him, to her, in his true form, in his full and true splendors, and thereby remove any doubt as to his real identity. Here you find the very same principle that Bayne tells us about in the idea of the mercy and the wrath of God. That as long as man has faith, he knows only mercy. But when he doubts, mercy changes into wrath. As faith, he sees only the beauty of God. As fear, or as negative emotion, he opens himself to the law of God, which appears as the great wrath, or the lawfulness, in which the principle of mercy is completely invisible, though it is ever present. Zeus tries every way possible to convince Semele that she should not exact this demand. But she insists, and it is said then that the great god took upon himself the slightest of the panoply of his powers, as little of his grandeur as possible, but and appeared to her as a magnificent power or blazing being. And of course the very light of his presence utterly consumed her. It was then, of course, that he also rescued his son, who was born at that moment, from the burned and charred ashes of the child's mother, and carried the child back with him to Olympus, to where it was to become later the savior god of the Greeks. But it was, therefore, again, Zeus moving out of his own nature, first as subtly as possible, and then in the presence of doubt or of fear, or perhaps the idea of prove it, which we so often use. Prove exteriorly that which is an internal mystery. And the words spoken at the time of the crucifixion of Christ, if you be the Son of God, come down from the cross, save yourself. And in this peculiar situation in psychology, we have one of the elements that is quite interesting in the Greek myths, because Zeus is a very intriguing situation to cope with in the sphere of mythology. Remember, this divinity was symbolically delineated by a very highly psychological and philosophical people. Much more so, perhaps, than most of the other races with which we are familiar at that period in culture development. But to come back to Zeus now, he exists in this form, and through his mixing with the beings on all planes, we find that he brings forth various progeny. But this various progeny nearly always has a strange and tempestuous career, because they become instruments of evolutionary procedures in all of these spheres of existence. But Zeus, in order to escape all involvement and to produce a power suitable for his own needs, creates or generates out of his own mind what the ancients in India might have called the mind-born god. In this case, the mind-born god is a goddess. And in this case, the goddess is Pallas Athena, born of the god by an immaculate conception within his own being. We have, therefore, knowing, truth, the nature of being, producing out of itself its handmaiden, whom, like the Brunhilde of the Odinic rites, becomes the alter ego of her own father. This being, Minerva, or Pallas Athena, born full grown, helmed and speared, and carrying upon her arm her father's shield, the shield of the great sky god. This particular power, therefore, is appropriate and naturally associated with the highest and most abstract form of knowledge, which is wisdom. Wisdom is the immaculately conceived offspring of truth. Wisdom is born unpolarized. And this is very important, inasmuch as it represents a complete synthesis of all reasoning powers. There is ignorance, and there are very many aspects of knowledge and lack of knowledge. But wisdom, as personified by Athena, the Greek concept of wisdom, is unpolarized. Ignorance to them is not the opposite of wisdom. Ignorance is the opposite of knowledge. There can be no opposite to wisdom, because wisdom represents a divine thing in its own nature. It is not worldly wisdom. It is not wisdom arising from the labor of man. It is wisdom bestowed by God. Therefore, it is the highest form of the wisdom principle. Minerva or Pallas Athena actually, consequently, becomes associated with a great number of attributes. First of all, she is a virgin, being the only deity of importance in the pantheon from whom no progeny descend. She is never involved in any relationship other than to serve her father. And in him, she is complete, and in her, he finds his own complement. He is the only being in whom he confides. And she is his right arm in all the things that he does. It is consequently this thought that Zeus, through wisdom, who becomes his handmaiden or his agent, his primary agent in procedure, brings forth all things according to their orders. She becomes the mind maiden, who does whatever his will directs. In our various attributes, Athena then represents two kinds of wisdom. She is, first of all, a goddess of war. And secondly, she is a goddess of peace. As a goddess of war, we have her involved in the same concept as we find in the Bhagavad Gita, where Arjuna and Krishna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra try to analyze the meaning of war. The war over which Athena functions is the mysterious war of existence. And in this war, she always fights in the heavens for the victory of the right. Therefore, her battlefield is the world of the experience of created things. Therefore, she is wisdom, ensuring the ultimate victory of right over wrong. After the victory has been achieved, theoretically at least, although we do not have too much evidence of this victory in our daily experience, Athena then becomes the patroness of peace. And as the patroness of peace, she is also the patroness of a certain peculiar art, which is important in philosophy. She is the patroness of weaving. She is the one who weaves the threads and puts together the patterns. For weaving was, to the Greek mind, a very apt simile for such things as the wisdom of Plato or Pythagoras, the weaving together of knowledge to form the great tapestry of living truth. Therefore, she supplies the threads of life and time, experience, effort, hope, fear, and from all these things are woven together the mysterious tapestry. And this occurs to us again because Athena was the one who brought to the wife of Ulysses, Penelope, the strategy of weaving the tapestry, which she continued to weave, and which she used as an excuse for not accepting the suitors who sought to gain her favors while her husband was away. There's a very clever and interesting involvement there, that Penelope will not stop weaving until the tapestry is done, and every night she unravels what she has woven the day before, so that the tapestry is never finished. This strategy was given to her by Athena as a means of protecting her virtue while the hero Odysseus was passing through the great initiations of Poseidon, as set forth in the Odyssey and the Iliad. Now, Athena also was called the tamer of horses, because to the ancients, she and she alone represented the power to bridle the winged horse Pegasus. She alone could ride him. She alone could place the bridle of control upon him. And she also was able to break the steeds of Bellerophon, another tremendous problem in Greek mythology. Athena, as the horse tamer, became the symbol of wisdom as the tamer of the will, the horse being the symbol of the will. And of course, the enlightened or illumined will becomes the winged horse, the ancients called the horse of high verse, the horse of the muses, who stamped with his hoof upon the earth of Parnassus and brought forth the streams of Helicon. All these legends have a wonderful meaning if we can fit them together. So when once wisdom, or Athena, had become the proper servant of Zeus, Zeus was liberated into the power to create or fashion worlds. And out of this fashioning of worlds, we have a microcosmic analogy when we come into the study of man's own nature. We have within man what we might say in the Greek term the noa, the Greek idea of nous, the principle that regardless of whatever happens to the body, whatever happens to the individual during life or death, the noa, the archetypal being, the anthropos, remains unchanged, the over-self of Emerson. This knower, according to the Greeks, was Zeus. And this knower reaching into manifestation in the psychological integration of man, brings forth as its servant, as its instrument, and as its living agent the higher principle of wisdom. And this higher principle of wisdom is finally associated with and embodied into the concept of buddhi. For the knower becomes identical or identified with illumination, intuition, and these other high attributes of consciousness. Pythagoras and Plato both point out that this buddhic principle, which represents man's spiritual internal power to approach the knower, is equivalent to the consort of Zeus. Therefore, Zeus, abiding in his own peculiar realm, makes as his first adjustment with existence his union with the world buddhic principle, or in the case of man, with the energy of spiritual knowing, which is resident and which forms the consort or shakti of Zeus. This spiritual knowing, however, as in the case of Jupiter and Juno, is static. Therefore, to overcome this and to bring the precipitation of existence into objectivity, Zeus produces this unpaired power, Athena. And this unpaired power becomes the means by which man is able to achieve his own liberation, and by means of which also the divine power is able to create. The divine power, therefore, moving through the attribute of absolute wisdom, which is absolute conformity with absolute law, precipitates by means of Athena the monastic principle, or the principle of mind. Athena is the bridge between consciousness and mind. And by virtue of mind, or the mind polarity in man, man becomes aware of the gods above and aware of his humanity below. Mind, therefore, is in this middle distance between all things. And mind is consequently the hermetic principle. When then we say that Hermes was the author of 80,000 books, all we are doing is saying that the mind is the author of all books. That the mind is therefore the principle of ingenuity. That the great dialogues of Hermes to Tatian represent nothing more or less than the mind forever instructing the personality. But the mind itself is not enough, for behind the mind must stand this power of true wisdom, from which the mind is able to gather its positive inspiration and in turn receive into itself the powers of the divine purpose. In the Gnosis and in other systems, we therefore have a Sophia, who stands in middle distance between the superior powers and the demiurgus. And it is Sophia who has the pure principle of wisdom that achieves the mysterious redemption. Minerva is Sophia. Minerva is also the strange maiden of the troubadours. The wisdom which is sung to as a beautiful, pure, virgin person. The true goal of all human regenerated desire. This being only the desire for truth. Minerva is not represented as emotional because of the importance of sublimating the karmic principle, which cannot be present in the true truth seeker. yet she is not evidently lacking in the greatest of all emotions, and that is devotion. And devotion to truth, Buddha says, is the only permissible emotion. Consequently, we begin to see some of these attributes falling into place. Now, out of this, we come to another cycle that is important. We've already mentioned to you that we have produced an ego or a selfness. We have tied it with a link or bridge, the golden bridge of hope. We have tied it to the monastic principle of mind. And we have set up a kind of creation. Now, in the Greek mythology, creation consists of three processes, of which the first is a generation. Because in the Greek, they did not believe that something came from nothing, as the way we consider creation. Rather, they considered creation as a generation from divine sources. That creation was an eternal condition moving from its own internal suspension into manifestation, remaining in manifestation through four ages or eras, which correspond to the Indian yugas, and then returning again into its own nature by the retiring of all objective things. Thus an outflowing and an inflowing within a great cycle of time. And in this cycle of time, there comes the age of iron. And in the age of iron, we come upon the mysterious symbol. We find out why Vulcan, Hespesius, is the deity of fire. Because fire alone works iron and the metals. He is therefore the Tubal-Cain, the builder, the one who casts the instruments, and who pounds swords into plowshares. He is also the one who creates the armament of the gods. Iron in the Greek mythology has a meaning that you have to think through twice, or you will not get the real point of it. Because actually we think of the age of iron as the least of the four yugas, or the four ages. But actually, the word iron to the Greek meant mind. The age of iron is the age of the mind. And over this power is Vulcan. For the fire of human experience, the flames of human aspiration, are used to temper iron. And the sword Excalibur of perfect steel that belonged to Arthur the king, and the great sword of the paladins of Charlemagne. All these swords represent iron gradually transformed by fire into steel. Take the sword of quick detachment and cut the snaky branches low, says the Gita, relating to the use of the sword to destroy illusion. The sword, therefore, is mind, iron is mind. The age of iron is the age of mind. And Vulcan is the kind of worldly experience which transforms mind into the steel of true enlightened willpower. In any event, we have this series of cycles. And here we've mentioned already the story of Dionysus, carrying this story from the time of the appearance of the god Zeus as a voice, to the point where obeying the secret instruction of Hera, Semele demands the appearance of Zeus in his full power and cosmic expression, and in this demand loses her life. Now we know that Zeus has taken the child and created a temporary womb for that child in his own body in order to save the life of the child. He then returns to his own abode, and selecting, according to one account, Athena, and according to the other account,
Hermes,
as his agent, has this child carried away to Nysa the Blessed, a land of mountains in the distant region of things. And the name of the region simply means in the abode of peace. And here, this infant is placed into the keeping of Silenus, the aged one. Now, Silenus is a kind of being who is a sort of satyr. He is a deity of strange and rather unprepossessing appearance, and in the Greek philosophy, it was accustomed in the time of the great Periclidean age for Socrates to be called Silenus, because they had the same rather disproportioned appearance, and he was often called Silenus. And it is quite probable that in the development of the personality of Socrates in the Platonic dialogue, an effort was made to perpetuate the mystery of Silenus and what he represented in the cosmic picture through the form of Socrates. Silenus was the nurse of Dionysus. His name, into a certain way, means meditation. He means internal life or internal expression. He means yoga. He takes the child Bacchus to his cave. And the cave in this place represents an internal state of knowing. In a mountain, which is the symbol of the glory of truth. And I shall lift up mine eyes to the hills from whence cometh my help. So the mountain is always the symbol of the divine abode. And here, surrounded by nature spirits, by satyrs and nymphs, by strange dryads, and creatures that do not belong to this world, the young god was brought up. But Hera was not satisfied. Her vengeance was not complete. So the young Dionysus was subjected to a terrible ordeal. With the assistance and conspiracy of the Titans, the primordial giants that had come down from ancient times, and presumably still including Cronus, Rhea, and the other great titanic deities, a fell plot was laid. A plot that is reminiscent of certain words in the opening chapters of Genesis, where it is said that God, perceiving the danger that man should become like God, caused him to be cast from the garden. Because if he ate of the tree of life, he would be truly as the gods. And to prevent this, he was cast out of the garden. Now, in this second situation, we have a similar conspiracy wrought in a different way. By means of a great mirror, the mirror now being the karmic plane, the young godling, Dionysus, was lured away from his safe retreat among the blessed hills of Nysa, lured away from peace, by the presentation of a reflection in a mirror. Here is your Narcissus problem. And here is also the story of the Japanese sun goddess Amaterasu Omikami. Because when she got into a pout and locked herself in a cave, the gods lost the sun and had no more light. And they could do nothing, but finally one of them hit upon a strategy. He told them to gather in front of the cave and talk loudly, saying that they had found a new sun goddess, more beautiful than the one who had locked herself in the cave. They then got a mirror of polished metal and held it in front of the cave. And the sun goddess, peeking out to see who this rival for her charms might be, saw an eye peeking back at her. She looked a little further, came out a little further, and saw her own radiant face. And having seen no such face before, was convinced that it was another person and dashed out of the cave to scratch the eyes out of her adversary. Whereupon the gods moved in behind and closed the cave behind her so she could never get back. From that time on, we had the sun reasonably and normally performing its duties. But in the case of Dionysius, the little god, seeing the reflection, thought it was another child like himself. And because he had been raised only by these strange aged satyrs and Silenus, and had known no playmates of its own kind, it ran out with its toys to play with this other child. And as it approached, the Titans drew back the mirror until the child followed its own reflections far into the most distant places of space. And when they had reached a very far and distant place, the Titans turned upon the child and attempted to capture it. Some say Dionysus himself, others say the gods that protected him, then caused the child to turn into innumerable shapes, like Albarak trying to escape the charms of Loki in the Grindgold. The little fellow changed from one shape to another, trying to deceive the Titans as to his true appearance. But finally, when he took upon himself the form of the bull, they fell upon him and slew him. And when they so did, they then, to hide their crime and to leave no mark thereof, decided to eat the body. So they cooked it upon a fire. And as they were cooking it, the odor of the cooking ascended through all the realms of space until Zeus upon his throne smelled the strange odor. Looking down with his all-seeing eye, he beheld immediately the truth of this matter, that his own son had been destroyed by the Titans. Therefore he launched his thunderbolts against them, by means of which they were all incinerated. He then, by his magical means, transformed his child again into its true likeness, and brought the child back to Olympus. In the so doing, however, he entrusted the head of the child, Bacchus, to Athena as its peculiar and proper guardian. And having restored the child to life, it received then the name of the twice born, or the one who had passed through death and had been restored again. Then, as the course of time went on, the gods, in the choice of materials for the creation of humanity, chose to make man out of the ashes of the Titans, and in so doing molded into every human body not only these ashes, but the flesh of Bacchus which the Titans had eaten. Therefore, every body that exists, every living person, possesses a temporal and exterior nature, titanic, uncontrollable, mad, derived from the 12 primordial giants, and within that nature also the blood of the eternal god of salvation, Dionysius Zagros. This legend is also interesting for another reason. Dionysus, in this legend, if you study the whole problem very carefully, becomes the symbol of the breaking up of the continuity of human consciousness through the mystery of rebirth. Dionysus, in this instance, represents, therefore, the many aspects of the soul in its journey, and the various forms into which Dionysius changes himself in the effort to escape destruction by the Titans, is, if properly read, the complete story of the evolutionary growth of man through the kingdoms of nature up to his present spiritual estate. This is interesting, furthermore, Because, of course, in this case, the Titans not only represent the primordial powers, but they represent the fact that the primary elements, as represented by the Titanic order of life, is also diffused throughout the universe. And that whereas the Titans, as principles, occupy in this principle the relation of heaven or Uranus, the Titans are also parts of matter and become involved in the mystery of Gaia, or the material element, the negative pole. Thus the 12 orders of material things, the 12 substances of nature, recognized by the Greeks, become the Titans that attempt to destroy or eat up the soul, and succeed in doing so in the mystery of incarnation. Zeus, however, turns his thunderbolts against the process of crystallization, destroys the power of matter, rescues his son, and restores him to life with the cooperation and assistance of Athena. The study of the toys of Dionysus, particularly the bull rattle which he carried, the story of the little god and all the things that happened to him are like the Narcissus legend, for Plato tells us that by Narcissus is to be understood man gazing into matter and seeing the reflection of himself in a material state, falling into this state and entering into a condition of spiritual obscuration, by means of which he falls under the power of the material powers of things and has the terrible disaster of being eaten up by the Titans. Now, another name for the Titans, of course, in your Greek mythology, there are 12 of them, and as you might suspect, they are the zodiac. Now, when Pythagoras wrote on the subject, he said, men falling into birth, or into embodiment, fall through the bodies of the 12 holy animals. Now, these 12 holy animals are the zodiac. Therefore, the story of the Titans represents also the destiny of man in the creational sphere, in which he is born through the bodies of animals, becomes, so to say, devoured by the sub-zodiacal universe, becoming captured and held in it, so that he becomes the victim of the forces and powers represented by the 12 titanic zodiacal signs, from which he is rescued ultimately by the mystery of Dionysus. And Dionysus then comes gradually into its full focus as representative of the soul, or the life of man that is born out of the experience mechanism of material or sidereal existence. The head, or the cause, or proper nature of the soul, is kept by Minerva as the principle of wisdom. Let us see a parallel of that, because each story differs enough so that unless you have all the stories, you cannot fit every part of it together. The last Orpheus, the Thracian bard, after the mysterious account of the loss of Eurydice, who descends unto the underworld, is rescued by Orpheus, but lost by him again because he does not obey the law of Kamaloka, where Hades is lord. He looks back before he has left the region, and for this is deprived forever of the symbol of this psychic part of his own nature. Orpheus, after this occasion, is possessed by a strange madness, and he wanders about the earth, singing melancholy songs and playing the most dismal and heart-rending tunes upon his lute. He goes on and on and on, and the whole world weeps with him, and the misery of it all is more than the world apparently can bear. And as he comes at last into Thessaly, He comes into the forest there, and the birds and the animals and the creatures of the forest all gather around him, as in the story of St. Francis. And they listen and join in the strange, sad, solemn sounds that come from the heartbroken poet and his instrument. And about this time, an order of Bacchantes that are called the Ciconian women, who ran in frenzied mobs through the forest, worshipping their deity, with torchlights and cries and shouts, are offended by the strange, sad melody, which is so different from their own. But the deity is immortal, for nothing can injure him while the music is being played. So what they do is to raise such a terrible din with their instruments and their voices that they drown out the music. And in this way, the poet is no longer immune. They taught to fall upon him, kill him, tear his body to pieces, and cast the remains into the river. Here, the head and the lute or instrument float down the stream, and the same strange melodies are heard. And in this psychological moment, Athena, descending from her celestial abode at the order of Zeus, gathers up the lute and the head, and returns with them to Olympus, where the head of the deity or of Orpheus continues to give oracles for ages. Later, a shrine is created for him on earth, and his lute and his head are placed there as a testimony to mankind. Athena again picks up a head and takes it back to Olympus. The head of Orpheus is the symbol of his doctrine, the esoteric school which gives oracles or continues to teach even after the body of the school has been broken up or torn apart by the chaos of ignorance, represented by the Ciconian Bacchantes. In the case of Dionysius, the soul is returned again to the father, and there it remains until it is set forth again as the young Dionysus. This was another appearance of it. We have Dionysus, we have Dionysus Zagros, and we have the Bacchantian Dionysus. They are all different deities, or rather different aspects of the Messiah principle in Greek philosophy. Ultimately, Dionysus becomes the conqueror of the world and the restorer of the glory of the spiritual kingdom of his father. He therefore becomes the inheritor of the world, taking the place of Zeus. And Zeus, even while Dionysus is a child, hands him his thunderbolts, the supreme symbol of his power. And in the Greek, we are told that the little child, who shall indeed lead them, is the symbol of purity. And that the principle, therefore, of Dionysus is the principle of purity, the principle of regeneration, resulting in the guileless one who is represented as a child, in whose nature there is no evil, and that to this one and to this one alone Zeus can bestow his thunderbolts, and therefore he permits Dionysus to sit upon his throne, use and inherit his powers even while a child. And Dionysus returns to the legends of Christianity and Europe under the Galahad story and under the White Knight and the Guileless One, who for whom the Siege Perilous is forever waiting. That is the seat of the stranger, the seat of the one who is promised. Dionysus is the promised one, the only being in all the world to whom Zeus will entrust the supreme symbol of his power, because he knows that in this one it will never be used to injure. All of these legends take a great deal more description than we can put on them. But we then come to another interesting type of point. We are now moving inevitably toward another cycle, the cycle of the ones who have to fight with the Titans. And of this cycle, we have certain heroes. For as surely as this divine order is moving downward from the celestial, through the spiritual, through the intellectual, through the emotional, and into the physical world, so the earth is producing the harvest of the dragon's teeth. For these teeth were sowed in the earth, and they raised an army. And the army turned upon itself to destroy itself, which was, of course, a story of mortality and mankind. But there was also being born by the union of gods and earth another group of creatures possessing certain attributes or powers. In this group we have such beings, such heroes, as Odysseus or Ulysses. We have a more direct and magnificent example, perhaps, of the entire heroic concept in Hercules. We have the hero warrior in Achilles. We have the hero leader or organizer in Agamemnon. We have the hero sage in Nestor. We have a whole group of heroes. We have the heroic journey of the Argonaut. We have the mysteries which have to do with the rescue of Andromeda and many other things, in which the hero is forever coming into focus. The hero as Oedipus facing the mystery of the Sphinx. Always the hero, and nearly always the hero as the dying god, or the tortured one, or the one bearing forever the scars of the struggle against the mysteries of providence. Therefore, we have a new order now coming up from the earth, the orders of the heroic beings. These are the ones who are moving out from below upward. They are the ones in whom the blood of Bacchus, which was locked in the compound of the creation of man, is beginning to gain ascendancy over the ashes of the Titans. And because of this blood of Bacchus being inevitably and properly within them, they have the power to reach and climb up the mountains that lead to the Olympian heights. Thus out of the earth come Prometheus and Apelles, come the great heroes who are going to be the saviors. Also the strange races that are generated there, like the centaurs under the leadership of wise old Chiron. All of these become parts of this story, which now turns abruptly and begins to move from below upward, in which man, having certain binding ties, being bound eternally to heaven by a power even greater than the gods, asserts his sonship. And also, as in the Sigurd saga, how Zeus, entering into a conspiracy with his fellow gods, seeks first to impede this progress and later to advance it, to impede its premature statement, to prevent man from attaining heaven without labor, but moving around to produce a situation that forces man upward, and by this forcing ultimately brings or restores the dead Dionysus to life. It is quite an interesting and complicated subject, so we'll have to work on that one a little bit next week.